These are our Tuesday night classes, which we call the Lifestyles classes, and they differ from the Sunday classes. The Sunday classes are transformational, topical, whereas the Tuesday classes, as those of you who have been coming know, that they're more informational. They deal more with the nuts and bolts of Krishna consciousness, people that have been inspired, and they want to know more about the specifics. And we've been doing this series for over a year now, and it's included sessions on the Guru, the importance of the Guru, offering your food, prasadam, Ekadasi, the Goswamins. We've taken each one of the Goswamins and looked at their lives in detail. And what we're doing in this extended series is dealing with science and God. These slides were crafted by Radhe Shyam, the president of Pune Temple. And we're using these slides as a lout line for the series. And right now, we're in the sixth part, which is called, If There's One God, Why Are There Many Religions? This is the sixth of six general categories, and this is the third part of this particular topic. If there's one God, why are there many religions? And where we ended up last time, at the end of the second session, was with the three modes of material nature. And the Puranas prescribe different types of worship for people according to the modes of nature that they're in. We gave this in the first class, we gave this example in the second class, and we're going to give it in this class too because it's so relevant. You can't get fire from earth. You can't take earth and ignite it. There has to be an intermediary step, and that is that you plant a seed and you get wood, you get a tree, then you can ignite the tree. So similarly, you cannot give knowledge, higher knowledge of the personality of God, to people in the modes, the lower modes of material nature. They're just not going to understand it, and it's going to be a waste of time. Prabhupada used the example, you can have wet grass, moist grass, or dry grass. The wet grass is compared to the person in the mode of ignorance. The moist grass is the mode of passion. And the dry grass is the mode of goodness. So when you throw a spark, let's call that the spark of transcendental knowledge, or the first encounter with a Krishna conscious devotee, and he starts telling you about devotional service. If the person's in the mode of ignorance, that person's like wet grass. The spark is just going to go out right away. If the person is in the mode of passion, the spark probably is going to go out, but it might have a small chance of igniting, but not much. If you throw the spark into dry grass, it'll immediately ignite. There'll be a conflagration. And we've seen that. Normally, it takes so much effort, and literally you almost have to shed blood to get someone to the point of becoming a full-time devotee. But not always. Not always. And I'm sure that those of you who are experienced devotees have had this experience once or twice in your life where you just went out in the street or you did a book table or you met someone and you told them a few things. You weren't even very articulate about it. And lo and behold, they just became a devotee. I know Vaibhavi met one German girl in the streets of Australia about 1970. She gave her back to Godhead magazine. She came back the next day and joined the temple. That was, what's her name? Renate Clark. Wait, huh?
Renata?
Yeah, Renuka or something like that. Hari Sori, who was the servant of Prabhupada and wrote so many memoirs about Srila Prabhupada. She met him and he became a devotee within a couple of days. She just met him on the street. Also in Australia, I remember there was a fellow, Italian-looking guy, who came. We had some really good Sunday feasts. We'd rented, we had a storefront downtown Melbourne in Little Lonsdale Street, and it had a big hallway in the back. So on Sundays, we used the hallway for our Sunday feasts, and we would have a beautiful feast, which we'd brought in from the St. Kilda Temple, and we'd be dancing back and forth and chanting. Oftentimes we had puppet shows. Vaibhavi made the puppets. And they were really good feasts. So this fellow, he looked kind of Italian, and we had big crowds. We had well over 100 people every Sunday, 120. And so I'd noticed him as a face in the crowd one or two times. And after the puppet show and the lecture and the chanting, I was eating my prasadam, sitting on the floor. And he came up, and he says, can I join? And I'm saying, yeah, right. You've been like three times, you know? Sure. All right. And I said, yeah, come. This is our address in St. Kilda. Come on Monday morning, you know? And I thought, yeah, we'll never see this guy again. He came up. He showed up on Monday morning with his bags. He moved in the temple. And he's a great devotee, and now he's Ramai Swami, the GBC, Sannyasi GBC Guru of Australia. Just like that.
So,
Krishna Premi, yeah, Krishna Premi. Yeah. And then Wednesday she donated her life savings in the donation box anonymously, $300, and she could no longer afford her apartment, and then she moved into the temple. And she used to go out on Sankirtan and cry. She's in full view, downtown Sydney, you know, like four or five devotees chanting Hare Krishna. We used to go out every day, and she would just cry every day. Tears would just flow down her cheek. And she was a beautiful singer, so sometimes she was leading and crying at the same time, you know. So it only takes a few instances like that to be inspired for decades and decades and decades. I don't have... And when I was president in Berkeley also, I can't take credit. But Vatsal Das was the... he's president of Hawaii now. He was my bhakti leader in Berkeley. And he was a very charismatic, still is, attractive personality. And he was getting all these young, smart, really, really smart kids fresh out of high school to join the temple. We had 120 devotees in the temple. And they were, I mean, he would know the stories better than I do, because then I was like sort of one level removed from the actual making of devotees. But he was making a lot of devotees, really, really pure people. And so that requires you to be in the mode of goodness. And there are people out there that in their past lives, they've gone through the mode of ignorance, they've gone through the mode of passion, and they're in the mode of goodness. They're vegetarian, they're interested in philosophy and in compassion, and they're just waiting to meet devotees. And if we don't get out there, they're not going to meet devotees and they're not going to become devotees. So in a case like this, we can take very little credit. The only credit we can give ourselves is what, not that we're great preachers and not that we gave convincing arguments. The only credit we can say is we went out there. We went out there and we met these people, and if we hadn't gone out there, we wouldn't have met those people. See, there are not many of them. They're one in a million, but they're out there and they're just waiting to meet a devotee. And it doesn't matter what kind of a devotee, whether you're a good devotee or a bad devotee, or whether you're articulate or whether you can't speak or anything, they're in the mode of goodness, and it's just like throwing a match into dry grass. In fact, in Los Angeles, I've given you examples from Australia, I've given you examples from Berkeley. Every temple has its own sort of mood and flavor. Los Angeles has a lot of quasi-devotees, pseudo-devotees, fringe devotees, immature devotees, childish devotees, devotees that have been married more than once, and all these things. You know, you, whatever it is, you got it in Los Angeles. And yet a lot of these people make devotees. A lot of these people who are themselves not model devotees, by any stretch of the imagination, they make devotees because they meet people and they say something. They may not be practicing what they're preaching, but they say something. And that person is in a higher mode of consciousness, maybe even than that devotee. And so there are all kinds of people that come. I was in Los Angeles for the Rath Yatra a few weeks ago, and I did the question-answer booth. And one of the young ladies in there, she says, I'm just new to coming to the temple. I've just recently started chanting Hare Krishna, and I can't finish a round. She says, I just start crying and bawling. It's so ecstatic. I have yet to finish a round. I said, and what do I do about this? And so I asked the 30 or 40 people in the room. I said, would everyone like to have a problem like this? And they said, yeah, sure would, you know. And so anyway, she came up to me afterwards, and Jayadvaita Swami was standing with me. And she said, what advice can you give to me? And I said, look, you're going to the temple. You're starting to chant Hare Krishna. Be very careful who you associate with. There are hundreds of devotees in the temple going around. And don't just hang out with someone because they say you're a devotee. Because there's immature devotees and there's mature devotees. There are devotees that have not yet grown up spiritually, and there are devotees that have grown up spiritually. There are devotees that are still in the wading pool, and there are devotees in the deep water, swimming. There are devotees that are in the boat that are scared to get out of the boat. They're scared to trust Krishna. They've got all kinds of reasons, and they've got all kinds of people to blame for what they're not doing in Krishna consciousness. And there are other people that are out of the boat and they're walking on water. So just when you go to the temple, just pick two or three people, and when you talk to them, they only talk to you about Krishna. They don't talk to you about this person or this or that. They just talk to you about Krishna. Pick two or three people and just be friends with them. And you will go back home, back to Godhead. I don't know if that's relevant to our topic today, but I just wanted to say that. So you cannot explain to someone in the mode of ignorance the pure philosophy of Sanatana Dharma. Nor is it going to likely to be very well received by someone in the mode of passion. Mode of ignorance is characterized by sleep, indolence, lazy, hallucination, resentment. You know, it's not my fault. It's always someone else's fault. Someone else is being blamed. Ultimately, God's at fault for my own shortcomings. Even from the picture here, you see these are the followers of Kali. And they're attempting to offer Jad Bharat in this picture as a human sacrifice. So they eat meat and they have all kinds of rituals which are not elevating. They're not civilized. They're crude and they're vicious and they're nasty. So you cannot approach these kinds of people with the pure philosophy of devotion, of love of God. I don't know what's coming up here. Yeah. Here are some characteristics of worship in the mode of ignorance. They're fond of material prosperity. Those in the mode of ignorance generally approach Lord Shiva for benedictions, and those benedictions are they're dangerous. They're dangerous. The benedictions that are asked by people in the mode of ignorance from Lord Shiva are dangerous to other people. And if you know the story of Bomasura and Vrikasura, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Vrikasura, for instance, asks of Lord Shiva the benediction that whoever's head he touched, it would break into 1,000 pieces. Now, what kind of a benediction is that? You got Lord Shiva, you could ask for something that would enrich and benefit the whole world, and all you can think of to ask for is the head-touching, blowing-up benediction. So that's the characteristic of people in the mode of ignorance. They perform severe tapasya. This Vrikasura was cutting flesh from his body in order to force Lord Shiva to appear before him, and Lord Shiva thought, you know, well, this is appalling what this person's doing. Let me go see if I can talk some sense into him. They're addicted to intoxicants like bhang, ganja, marijuana. They offer animals or chickens in sacrifice, and sometimes even human beings to please Kali. Now, an example of worship in the mode of passion was Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu did severe austerities for 125 years by the calculations of the demigods. He stood on one leg with his arms in the air. His body, the flesh of his body, was eaten by ants so that there was only his skeletal structure and the life air was circulating somewhere other within the skeleton. And he forced Lord Brahma to appear before him because of the severity of his austerities. And again, he didn't ask for anything that was beneficial to society. He asked that he become immortal. And he wasn't able to achieve that, but in a roundabout way, he got some very substantial benedictions, which he used to conquer Indra and upset the peace and prosperity of the universe and create great turmoil. Now, we recommend worship in the mode of goodness. And Lord Vishnu presides over the mode of goodness. Vishnu is another manifestation of Krishna. Lord Brahma, having the job of creating, anyone knows who's created anything, you have to have a lot of passion to take something that's inert and get it rolling and give it a certain momentum. So Lord Brahma is in the mode of passion. The color of passion is red. Lord Shiva, as we mentioned, presides over ignorance, and the color of ignorance is dark. And Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna presides over goodness, and that's a white color. So we recommend that as the springboard for going back to the spiritual world. The mode of goodness is not synonymous with spiritual consciousness, but it's the springboard from which you can get purified. It's called sattva, and then transcendental consciousness is called vishuddha sattva, or purified goodness. But without goodness, it's almost impossible to elevate oneself to the transcendental platform. People in the mode of goodness, they'll worship Tulsi, they offer flower, fruits, and water with love and devotion, as recommended in the Bhagavad Gita. And the result of that kind of worship is purification of the heart. I remember in the Bhagavatam, there's one story about Aditi. She had some sons, I think, and she wanted them to kill Indra. I forget why she wanted them to kill. I forget what. Now, I better not tell that story because I'm not real clear on the details. But anyway, I think Aditi herself wanted to bring about the death of Indra, because he'd gone into her womb and cut up her sons into 49 parts and then made friends with them, something like that. But in any case, the type of worship that was recommended to her to destroy Indra was devotional service. She was recommended to worship Lord Vishnu with love and devotion. At the end of which, she gave up her resentment, she gave up her grudge, and she was willing to make amends with Indra. The result of devotional service is that one gets purified, and one elevates oneself to the highest platform. Okay. So the question is, who is God? There are also different types of worship which focus on the effulgence of the Lord. This is called Mayavadiism, impersonalism, or monism. Those who see the Lord impersonally, they don't penetrate the dazzling effulgence of the Lord. They simply see the power that's coming from the Lord, and they cannot discern that from the source of that power, the source of that energy is a person. It is said that in order to see the form of the Lord, one needs eyes anointed with love and devotion. Without those kinds of eyes, one perceives God as just an energy source, as some impersonal light or energy. But when we look at the creation and we look at all the planets so nicely organized, the sun rising and setting, the seasons change, such order, this argument in favor of a personal creator is called the teleological argument, where the immense order and detail that goes into the smallest and the greatest parts of the creation bespeaks of a creator, that this could not have happened and could not be running and being maintained by accident. We see a multinational corporation like Microsoft and its well-managed MNC with operations and branches all over the world. So based on that, we assume correctly that there is a person running and managing. And in this case, of course, everybody knows the name of Bill Gates. Nothing that complicated, that widespread, that effective could be running on its own without a director, an intelligent director. In the United States, we have a democratic government in the White House right now, and that democratic government, that democratic party, there is a person. There is a person who stands at the head of that party. His name is Barack Obama. So the question has to arise in the mind of any intelligent, discerning person, who is that person behind this gigantic manifestation? The arguments about detail and order we addressed in the very first part of this series called Can a Scientist Believe in God? And so we've gone a long distance since then, and now we're just postulating what we established previously, that this creation had to have been created by a person. Now, information about that person is revealed by Krishna through his Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says of himself, he's not talking about someone else. Some people mistakenly think that Krishna is a prophet or a saint. If he were a prophet or saint, he would not say, Mata sarvam pravartite, aham sarvasya. Aham means me. It doesn't refer to anyone else. Krishna is standing on the chariot facing Arjuna, and he's saying, aham sarvasya prabhava. Prabhava means emanates or comes from. Sarvasya means everything, and aham means I. He's telling Arjuna, I am the source of everything. Mata, again, first person singular, again, sarva, just like sarvasya, pravartate, says everything rests in me. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. This is what Krishna said. And then in the 14th chapter, 4th verse, he says, this is 39th verse of the 10th chapter. He explains that he is the seed-giving father of all living beings. You see those little lights in the hearts of the elephants and the, looks like water buffalo or cows and the giraffes and the people and the monkeys, as well as the demigods. He says, I am seated in the hearts of all living beings and maintaining them. I'm the generating seed. There's no being, moving or non-moving, that can exist without me. And then these diacritics are a little bit hard to read, so I'm just going to go to the translation here. In the 9th chapter, 10th verse, Krishna says, this material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. The question sometimes comes up when we see Krishna on the altar, we see pictures. People wonder, well, why is he so young? And in fact, he was on the planet for 125 years. He spoke the Bhagavad Gita in the 90th year of his manifest pastimes. And if you look at the pictures of him, he still looks like he's about 16 or 18 years old. So people say, well, why does he look so young? And the answer is that God is supreme. That means that nothing controls him. He controls everything. So time and matter, Krishna says, this material nature, which is only one of my energies, it's a vast energy. It completely surrounds and subdues us and bewilders us. I'm looking out the windows here on this hilltop in Spanish Fork, and there are trees and sunsets and farmlands and cows and horses and mountains. And this is all just one of Krishna's energies. And it is dominated by him. Both matter and time are controlled by him. Matter and time do not control the Lord, but he controls all energies. That means matter and time do not have the power to make him age. They do not have the power to make him age. We are living entities, parts and parcels of God, but we're in material bodies, and we age because of the action of time on these material bodies. But Krishna is not in a material body. He is spirit through and through. There's no difference between his inside and his outside. And that form of Krishna is in control of everything, time and matter. So there is no power above God which would cause him to age. I don't want to age. But because, newsflash, I'm not God, I'm forced to age. God, presumably, I don't want to age, and I'm coming from God. So God, also, my source, presumably, he doesn't want to age either, right? But the difference between him and me is that he's God, and I'm not God. So even though I don't want to age, I have to age. He doesn't want to age, he doesn't have to age, because he's God. And there's no one can make him do something he doesn't want to do. Therefore, he's young. And I don't know who that person is on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but he's definitely not God. He's definitely not God. He's an imposter. Krishna goes on here. The whole cosmic order is under me. That's what I just said. Under my will, it is automatic. Krishna's will is not to age, so that his will is supreme. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again, and under my will, it is annihilated at the end. We're just running through verses here, all kinds of verses in the Bhagavad Gita to establish the supremacy of Krishna. I, aham, ojasa. I enter into each planet, and by my energy, they stay in orbit. So, according to the Bhagavad Gita, is the universe created by a person? Absolutely. And who is that person? Well, Krishna is claiming to be that person in the Bhagavad Gita. Yad yad vibhuti mat sattvam srimad orjitam eva cha tad tad eva gacchatam mama te jamsha sambhutam. Everything that we see in the material creation, not only in this planet, but throughout all the planets, and there's life on every planet. Every planet is teeming with life, with cities, with civilizations, with empires, with kings and executive heads and presidents. This planet is not unique. Every single planet has life to the same full extent that this planet has. And there are millions of planets, millions of universes, and this whole material creation, Krishna describes, mamanksha, it is but an anksh, it is but a little tiny spark of my splendor. Lord Krishna not only claimed himself to be God, but he proved it by showing the whole universe within his belly when he opened his mouth to show Mother Yashoda. You know, when Krishna was exhibiting his childhood pastimes on the planet, one time the boys came back from herding the cows and they accused Krishna of eating dirt. And Mother Yashoda said, your friends are saying you ate dirt. Is that true? And Krishna said, no. If you don't believe me, just look in my mouth. If I've been eating dirt, you should be able to see some evidences of dirt in my mouth. And Mother Yashoda said, open your mouth. So Krishna opened his mouth, and she looked in his mouth, and she saw the same universal form that Arjuna saw in the Bhagavad Gita. She saw time and space, past, present, and future. In the mouth of Krishna, she saw the upper planets, she saw the demigods, she saw the middle planets, she saw the lower planets, she saw the demons. She saw everything. And it gave her vertigo, just as it did to Arjuna. And she wasn't interested in pursuing this, because she couldn't love everything. She couldn't love a form which encompassed everything. She wanted to love Krishna, the specific form of Krishna, the source of all beauty, all wealth, all fame, all knowledge, and all renunciation. So then she said, just close your mouth and don't eat dirt again if you did it. I don't like that. And she didn't want to go there any more than Arjuna did. She just wanted to love Krishna as her son, as Arjuna wanted to love Krishna as his friend. Now, if you're in the mode of ignorance, if you're in the mode of passion, or even if you're in the mode of goodness, you can't understand this. You can't understand how this devotee looks in God's mouth and he shows all his universal form, and then she's not interested in that. You know, to understand God or to get darshan of God is the goal of yogis and jnanis and ascetics and all kinds of people. They want to become God conscious, they want to know God, or they want to merge with God, they want to become one with God. This universal form, they try to imagine that, they try to approach it through penances and austerities and studying the scriptures for many, many lifetimes, and they're lucky if they even understand even a glimpse. And here Mother Yashoda has it presented to her from within the mouth of her son, and then she says, just, I don't want to go there. I'm not interested in that. I've got something far beyond the modes of material nature, Shiva, Brahma, or even Lord Vishnu. I've got a personal relationship with Krishna. Elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, those who worship me, yesham tu antagatam papam jnanam punya karmanam. Yesham tu, they have not committed sins in many, many previous lifetimes. Yesham tu antagatam papam. They have not committed sins in so long they can't even remember the last time they committed sin. Bhajanti mam dridavataha. Those people who are firm and fixed in their vows and their duty and in righteousness, they worship me with all their heart. So you can't worship Krishna with feeling and love on the level of Mother Yashoda without having a purified heart. And you can't have a purified heart without at least being in the mode of goodness and taking it from there with the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. So that's why there are different types of religious systems. Although there's one God, there's different ways of approaching Him. There's different systems depending on where you're at. It can be a gradual process, and there can be many steps to the ladder. But the point of the Vedic latticework, the point of the Vedic network, is that everybody can make advancement from where they are. If they're in the mode of ignorance, they can elevate themselves through the Vedas to the mode of passion. If they're in the mode of passion, they're willing to submit themselves to the Vedic recommendations, they can elevate themselves to the mode of goodness. And then when they're in the mode of goodness, they're worshipping Lord Vishnu and being respectful and grateful and awe and majesty, and then from there they can elevate with the proper instruction to the pure platform of love of Krishna. And the interesting thing is, when you're on that highest, purest, sinless platform, you don't know that Krishna is God. You don't know that Krishna is God. And all the other levels you're striving, like striving upward, upward, knowing that somewhere, when you're purified, when you're qualified, when you get to the top floor of the skyscraper, when you get to the top rung of the ladder, there will be God in all of His glory and all of His majesty, and you'll be bowing down before Him and chanting hosannas and hallelujahs. And yet the purified souls, like the gopis, Arjuna, and Mother Yashoda, they're not interested in God in awe and majesty. They're not interested in that. They're interested in God as their friend or their son or their associate or their lover. They don't even... It's not important that Krishna is God. In fact, it's not only is it not important, but it is dampening, it is counterproductive to the feelings of love they have for Him. They want Krishna to feel dependent upon them. And if they were to realize that Krishna is God and that He actually is not dependent upon them in any way, shape, or form, they would be despondent. They would be despondent. And Krishna wants their love, He wants their service, and so there's nothing He's going to do to discourage them from their path of bhakti or devotional service. In the Brahma Samhita, Krishna was known as Govinda, is the supreme Godhead. He has an eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin, and He is the prime cause of all causes. So we'll just end with this quote this evening, because we're going to start yoga here, presumably. Who is this Krishna? Who is this Krishna who spoke the Bhagavad Gita. Well, there's many expansions of Godhead. There are many, many, many avatars throughout cosmic history. One time Prabhupada said, there are as many incarnations of Godhead as there are particles of dust passing across a sunbeam coming through the window. You've all seen particles of dust come crossing a sunbeam. So there's as many incarnations of God as there are sunbeams coming through a window. This isn't like in 100 years or 1,000 years. This is throughout hundreds of thousands and millions of years of cosmic history. God comes with regularity. And there are different expansions. There are different categories. We've talked about the Vishnu avatars, Shirodakshay Vishnu, Garbhodakshay Vishnu, Mahavishnu, who create this universe. We've talked about the Guna avatars. We've talked about those tonight. The three modes of material nature, Vishnu, goodness, Shiva, darkness, Brahma, the creator, passion. We've talked about the Das avatars, the half-man, half-lion. We've talked about Vamana, the dwarf avatar, the fish avatar, the tortoise avatar. And we've talked about Lord Vishnu himself, who is God in awe and majesty. But the source of all those avatars is described by Shukadeva Goswami. Ete kanksha kalo pum sham Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. All those avatars I mentioned, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of avatars, they are either plenary portions or portions of Lord Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is so powerful, in fact, that he can fully reproduce himself. He can produce what we call plenary expansions. And most of those ones that I just mentioned are fully empowered as God. They're worshipable. They have temples all over India. But if you visit the Varaha temple, the Nisringa temple, or the Brahma temple, or the Shiva temple, actually you're not worshipping different gods, but you're worshipping the plenary expansions of the one God. And so although these various expansions are full expansions, they're worshipable, still there is the distinction made between them and Krishna. And it is like that between milk and yogurt. From milk you can get yogurt, and they're both equivalent. They're both dairy products. It's basically, in most ways, there's no difference between the two. But the distinction is that once you've got, from milk, you've got yogurt, you cannot then go back and from yogurt get milk. So you, from Krishna, you get all the various Vishnu expansions, and they're almost as powerful as Krishna. They're what we call plenary expansions, or plenary portions. But Krishna is considered the fountainhead. He's the source. He's the origin. And those who are the topmost transcendentalists, far beyond the mode of goodness, and who have the opportunity to meet lovers of the Lord, become themselves enlightened and in love with Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead.